You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. In his 2010 book, The Big Short, Michael Lewis told the story of the derivatives and securities that were at the heart of the 2008 financial crisis. Well, in his new book, Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt, he shines a light into the dark corners of high-frequency trading, a system that relies on secrecy, deception, and extreme speed. Mr. Lewis decodes high-frequency trading and follows a group on Wall Street who figure out the algorithms and complex technologies behind this practice and attempt to fight back against what they see as an unjust system. Flash Boys is published by Norton, and I'm so glad Michael Lewis is joining us now to talk about it. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Andy.
And first of all, Michael, let me just say we've never spoken before, so I just want to thank you for the many hours of reading pleasure that you've given me over the years. How about that?
As have you.
All right. We should cut this out right now.
Go ahead.
Let's talk about something scary instead. And this is scary because we all have money in the stock market, and this book is saying some pretty scary things about it. You begin your story with a man named Brad Katsuyama, who worked for the Royal Bank of Canada. What did he notice was going on when he made a trade?
He was the head of stock market trading at the Royal Bank of Canada in New York. And he noticed in kind of early 2008 that the stock market on his screens was no longer the real market. So he sits there, you know, buying and selling large blocks of stocks from, you know, mutual funds and hedge funds and so on and so forth. And he has to sort of lay off that stock in the market. And up until that point, when he looked at his screens and it said, I don't know, like in the various stock exchanges, there were 10,000 shares of Microsoft bid for at $20 a share. If he hit a button, he would sell those 10,000 shares of Microsoft at $20 a share. What happened was, all of a sudden, when he hits the button, the market goes away. It just vanishes. The seemingly 10,000 shares of Microsoft bid for $20 a share aren't, and when he tries to buy them, the stock goes up on him. And so it's what he notices in short is that it's as if the market knows what he wants to do before he does it. And he's not the only one who notices this. I mean, lots of money managers notice that all of a sudden the market seemed to be able to anticipate whatever it was they were going to do and kind of run ahead of them. But what was interesting about Brad Katsuyama is he decided he was going to get to the bottom of it and try to figure out why this was happening.
Well, how did he get to the bottom of it?
Well, that's the book, right? We could be here a long time, but in the beginning, what he did is he drew in people from different parts of the industry of the stock market to the Royal Bank of Canada to conduct a kind of science experiment about what was going on in the market. And he drew in people from, you know, everybody from people who were very familiar with the way the newly electronic markets functioned, like the way the software functioned, to people who understood, you know, where the fiber was laid under New Jersey that connected all the markets to one another. But what he ends up doing over a period of several years is sort of identifying various predatory strategies used by high-frequency traders who have faster connections, faster information from the exchanges, and faster ability to respond to whatever's going on in the exchanges. So they, in effect, sing prices before everybody else. But what he discovers in this particular case is when he's hitting his button to, you know, say buy Microsoft on 13 different stock exchanges in New Jersey, his signal from his desk in southern Manhattan is traveling up a fiber optic line up that runs up the West Side Highway and through the Lincoln Tunnel. And when it gets to the other side of the Lincoln Tunnel, it arrives first at the BATS stock exchange, one of four data centers where the U.S. stock exchanges trade. And there are waiting for him high-frequency traders who divine what he's up to, and they race him with their faster connections to all the other exchanges in New Jersey and buy the Microsoft in front of him and sell them back to him at a higher price. So So he figures out that the problem in that particular case is just the physical distance between exchanges, and that these guys on the inside have the thing wired so they can first deduce what he's doing at the first exchange his order lands on, and then beat him to all the other exchanges to do what he wants to do before he does, so they can charge him for the privilege of doing it.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and I am talking to the very frightening Michael Lewis, who has a new book out called The Big Short. I'm sorry, not The Big Short. That was your last book, Flash Boys.
That was the last frightening book.
But I just, you just keep on scaring us about every 3 or 4 years.
But I don't mean, that's not what I mean to be doing.
No, it's just, it's like I can't handle the truth. You're just telling me the truth, and I can't handle it.
So The Big Short I found to be a very scary story in the sense that we managed to generate, a world historic financial crisis because basically people on Wall Street were able to create things that other people off Wall Street didn't understand and hide lots of risk from everybody. And it was, the postmortem on that is terrifying, and I agree. What interested me about this was that there were actually people, there was a beating heart on Wall Street, that there were actually people in the system who were disturbed by the way the system worked, and it's so disturbed that they were willing to put careers at risk and so on and so forth to try to figure it out and see if they could devise a solution. And so I felt that this was, I guess it's scary. It's scary if you knew nothing about what was going on in the stock market. What I thought was great about this is they may have actually started to solve problems that, for whatever reason, our regulators don't want to solve.
Well, let's break it down for our audience who may not be so familiar with these nuances of trading. What is flash trading exactly? How did it start, and who was doing it first?
All right. Well, so the market flash trading or high speed trading has a history that goes back to the crash of '87, if you really want to take it all the way back then. But the markets broadly, the financial markets, not just the stock market, have become completely automated. That you used to have, human beings on the New York Stock Exchange having to handle every order and match buyers and sellers, and that doesn't happen anymore. It's all done by computers. And once human beings are taken out of the middle of the market can move at a different sort of speed. It can all of a sudden. We're in computer time, not human time. And in computer time, a second is forever. And lots and lots and lots of trades can happen in a millisecond, a thousandth of a second. So the game of getting speed advantages that were meaningful in a very big way, I think, starts kind of 2005, 6, and really explodes in 2007 and 8. And what happens is, the process of automating, taking human beings out of the market, is very bad for Wall Street. It's sort of like removing Wall Street from the process, removing middlemen from the process of matching buyers and sellers. And you can think of what's happened since as a way of inserting Wall Street back in. The stock exchanges in the middle of 2000s began to allow high-frequency traders, and these people are the firms mainly you would never have heard of their names. I mean, big Wall Street firms like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley are engaged in it, but the best ones are little smaller proprietary shops in New Jersey. But these firms are allowed to set up inside the exchanges and place their computers right next to the exchange, the computer that matches buyers and sellers in the stock market. And for a fee to the exchange, they are given special access to the data inside the market, and they're able to see where the market is moving before everybody else, and they're able to respond to the changes in prices on the exchange before everybody else, and able to get basically a picture of the market that you and I can't get. There's sort of two separate issues. One issue is how did the market get automated, and that's a long story that goes back 20 years. And the second issue is how, once it was automated, did this kind of scalping in the middle of it get allowed? And that's an issue that really only goes back, in a big way, 5, 6, 7 years. And the scalping ends up being allowed, in my view, because it basically is a way for Wall Street, for the system, for the exchanges, for the banks, the people who control stock market orders, to capture some money from each of those orders where they may not. And the thing that was kind of shocking to me is that the high frequency traders in their ability to exploit every order because they have time advantages over everybody else, they may make the kill, but they basically share the kill with both stock exchanges and everybody and the banks and brokerage firms that handle the stock market orders. So everybody kind of has a piece of this. But it all arises so that the ability of a high frequency trader to exploit ordinary stock market orders is driven by two things. One is that this is superior advantage in information and in speed at individual exchanges, and the second is the fragmentation that's happened in the stock market, and that's the other big story. I mean, it used to be that the stock market mostly traded on the New York Stock Exchange, and that was it, with NASDAQ being a small piece on the side. Now there are 13 public exchanges in New Jersey and another 46 private markets run by banks, and they're all physically separated from each other. And this fragmented system sort of it enables the intermediary to keep buyers apart from sellers so that they can be intermediated by high-frequency traders for a fee. But it's a long, and how all this happens is a book story. I mean, it's sort of a long and complicated story involving lots of well-intended regulation and very clever people exploiting the regulation.
You know, when you described the list of people who benefit from high-speed trading, the traders, the exchanges, the banks, the one group of people you left off that list was us, the people who actually want to buy or invest in stocks. Are we, in essence, the suckers in this game? Are we the ones who are providing the capital, but we're getting ripped off?
It's a tax on investment. I mean, essentially, and it's a tax that probably very large institutions are more worried about, like mutual funds or pension funds or hedge funds, because they actually see, when they have big orders, they can see, you know, orders to buy 100,000 or a million shares of something. They get front run in a big way. But every stock market order is exploitable. I mean, there's a reason why online brokerage firms like E-Trade and TD Ameritrade sell the right to trade against their customer orders to high frequency traders. So it ends up being a hard to pin down number, but some billions of dollars a year tax on just investment. And so what it ends up being is, so not just a tax on the investors who are putting money into the market, but it becomes a tax on the economy. I mean, it makes it more expensive for companies to raise capital, and in a way that even all that is trivial in relation to the problems created by a system that is rigged to be so complicated for the benefit of intermediaries, that it is unstable. I mean, one of the really interesting things about this story, I think, is that it's not as simple as a small band of brothers led by Brad Katsuyama figuring out the system's rotten and going after it. People, major institutions inside the system, Charles Schwab, Goldman Sachs, think the system's rotten too. I mean, the system itself is a kind of, there's a civil war inside it because it's gotten so bad. And so you have things like flash crashes and IPOs that don't work and NASDAQ going down for hours at a time and so on and so forth because the software that runs the system has been made unnecessarily complicated. And it's been made unnecessarily complicated because it is forever being adapted to the needs of this unnecessary intermediary.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to Michael Lewis about his new book, Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt, all about high-speed, high-frequency trading of stocks. You do a very good job in the book of breaking down some of these technical terms that may be unfamiliar to us, certainly were unfamiliar to me. Can you explain what dark pools are?
So, as I was saying, the stock market has been allowed to fragment. So we have 13 public exchanges like NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange, and we also have these private markets that are called dark pools. And the private markets, they're called dark pools for a reason. So Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or J.P. Morgan, all the banks will have their own private dark pool, sometimes multiple dark pools. And it's a place where their bigger customers can trade without having the outside world see what they're doing. Or that's in theory what it's for. And so that the dark pool is not required to report whatever happens to it in real time to the world outside of it. So in theory, if you are, if you're a big mutual fund and you want to buy a million shares of company X and you don't want anybody to know what you're doing, you call Morgan Stanley and they put that order in the dark pool and nobody sees that's what you're trying to do. In practice, what has happened is the banks sell special access to the dark pools to high-frequency traders, and they use the dark pools essentially to hoard orders so they don't have to trade them on the public markets where they have to pay a fee to trade often. And it's efficient for them to trade inside their own dark – you trade the customer orders inside their own dark pool. You can think of them as little stock markets. That's what they are. They're little private stock markets run by the banks, in theory, for the benefit of the customers. But if you talk to the big investors, they have no idea what's going on in these dark pools. The dark pools don't have to publish the rules of the exchange. They don't have to explain. They don't have to tell their customers if there's some high-frequency trader lurking in there with a flashlight, able to see everybody. And that's what's happening. And Brad Katsuyama and his team of investigators are able to show you that the one of the big purposes, the use to which the dark pool is put, is for the banks to make money off the high-frequency traders exploiting their customers inside these dark pools.
So when you say that the banks are starting to get concerned that this is a rotten system, they're only concerned if it costs them money, because they're fine with it being a rotten system as long as they're benefiting from it, right?
This is a very good point. So I think it's a little more complicated than that, but you put it pretty well. So here's the conundrum for the big banks. To be a really good high frequency trader is not easy. It requires not just technical aptitude. It requires constant adaptability, because there are always new tricks to get faster or smarter as a high frequency trader. And the banks, for whatever reason, turn out to be not good at this. They don't move fast when new technology hits. So they have been kind of shoved aside to some extent by this new intermediary. I mean, it used to be that Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch, they used to be the middleman. And they are now sort of the helpmate to the middleman. And the middleman is this high-frequency trader you've never heard of. And it is clearly disturbing to the likes of Goldman Sachs that they can no longer run this game, that they're just, going to get their share, smaller share, paid to them by the actual middleman. So one of the reasons I think that you have this civil war emerging on Wall Street over the system is just that you're right, that the banks don't take as much out of this as they maybe think they should. But on top of this, that if you talk to people who run the stock market department at Goldman Sachs, and they've been particularly vocal about, like, the system is rotten, we need to change it. Yeah, they're talking their own book a bit, but I think they really do think that, as one of them said to me, we're going to have a flash crash times 10. We're going to have a total meltdown of the system, and we're going to get blamed for it, even though it's not necessarily just our fault. They think they have a big kind of legal reputational risk, and they want to get out in front of it, understandably. I agree with you that if somehow the banks were really, really, really good at high-frequency trading, and they could keep the lion's share of the kill in this predatory activity, I doubt you'd see dissension from the banks about the system.
On the plus side also, if there is another crash, you will get another book deal. So there is that.
Well, I think probably what will happen if there's another crash is that this book will get a new kind of attention. But I've said this three times, and I really do mean it, I think, this time. I'm a little sick of writing these Wall Street books. I do think that, enough about Wall Street. I mean, there are a lot of other things to write about it, but what has happened to me in the last, since the crisis really, is that I've been handed on a platter three unbelievable stories that you just kind of can't not write. I would like to think that eventually the system is going to be fixed and people like me will no longer be able to, it will no longer be the gift that keeps on giving to people like me.
Well, let's get back, because it is a great story you're telling in this book. You have, and it's a detective story, really, because Brad, your hero, assembles a group of very smart people to figure out exactly how the system was rigged, and they came up with a program they named Thor, so we've even got kind of a superhero element to this. Can you explain what Thor does?
Yeah. So Thor is the Brad Katsuyama, when he's a trader at the Royal Bank of Canada, his first response, this realization that what's happening is when he hits the button on his computer to buy Microsoft, that the signal is going first to Bats Exchange on the other side of the Lincoln Tunnel, and he's getting beaten to all the other exchanges by the high-frequency traders. And so what they figure out is they can, if they create delays in if they all of a sudden realize that when he hits a button, it's not as simple as the signal goes out in the market at exactly the same time. It looks that way to the naked eye, but it's arriving, you know, milliseconds difference at different exchanges. They can correct for that. So Thor sends the order so that it lands in all 13 exchanges at exactly the same time, within a few microseconds of each other, so that no high-frequency trader is alerted to what he's doing until he's actually at all 13 exchanges. And the minute he creates Thor, the minute they build this thing, the problem of that particular problem he was experiencing completely goes away. He's able to – the market on his screens is the market again, because they can't front-run him, because they don't know he's – they don't have this opportunity to race him from one exchange to the next. But it is, as he discovers, he first thinks that, he solved the problem, the big problem. And he goes out and he explains to investors that this is happening to them too, and they should use Thor, and they do. And but the digger, the further he digs, the more he finds that that particular act of predation, that predatory strategy that Thor was designed to defeat, was just one of many. So the problem is bigger than he can solve with just Thor.
Now, Brad has become somewhat of a target of criticism as a result of your book, hasn't he?
He's become a hero to many and a villain to a few. I mean, that's the truth. He's now been pulled in by the Justice Department and the New York Attorney General and the FBI and so on and so forth to help them with these investigations that they've launched into high-frequency trading, or the whole system, really. And he's gotten in arguments on TV with people who are invested in the system. He had a great shout fest on CNBC with the head of the Bats Exchange. But I don't think that anybody has watched it and thought he's done anything but won all of these exchanges. I mean, I think that he has if this were just me saying the stock market's rigged and it's a problem, I don't think anybody would pay any attention. Brad Katsuyama has assembled a team of like 35 very smart people who have in-depth personal knowledge of how the exchanges work and how the banks work and how the software works and how the hardware works. And he's got an airtight case, and he can show you how this predatory activity happens. So what has happened in response to him exposing this is, yeah, a lot of the people who are making money from it are furious with him. There's not much. It's very hard for them to land a blow, because he's got the truth on his side, and he can show it. And he's not, you know, he's, as he said to me when I kind of said I might like to write a book about this, he had already kind of made up in his mind that he was never going to work on Wall Street again, that he was going to try to create this fair stock exchange, and if it worked, it worked, and if it didn't work, he'd go do something else. So there's not much they can take from him. So I think he's finding this experience of being in the center of a maelstrom a little stressful, because it's not completely natural to him. I mean, what he is just like a nice Canadian guy. I mean, he's not radical by nature, but I don't think it's been really miserable. I think he feels like he's sort of winning.
Now, Michael, given that you have said in this book that the system is rigged, and you've pointed out in previous books other vagaries of Wall Street, I just want to know where you put your money. Where do you put your money so you can sleep at night? I know you're not an investment advisor, but I'm just curious.
It's a good question. I am a really, really boring investor. And my goal is just not to lose it. I don't think of the market as a place where I'm going to get rich. And so I do have money in the stock market, and I have it mainly in either like index funds, or some of it I give to Warren Buffett and let him worry about it. I figure if there's a catastrophe, that Warren Buffett will always end up on top of it. So that's my hedge, is to put some money into Berkshire Hathaway.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of it. In response to what I learned in working on this book, I sold some of my stock market holdings just because I thought, if in fact, as all these people seem to be suggesting who know how the system works, there's some sort of calamity, I'm going to feel like a fool if I didn't do something. But I don't actually have any concrete premonition of calamity. And I think that, what we're talking here is a system that scalps pennies from investors on trades. It's not like you can't make money in the stock market, or if the stock market goes up, you won't benefit. It's a more subtle problem than that. So it doesn't. It's not a problem that completely deters me from being an investor.
Well, that's good news. That's reassuring, sort of. I've been speaking with Michael Lewis about his latest book, Flash Boys, A Wall Street Revolt. It's published by Norton. Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Andy.